Welcome. I'm Michael Austin of the Hoover Institution, and this is the third and final episode in a series on America in the World, Great Decisions, America in the World 2020. This series grows out of a joint project that the Hoover Institution ran with the Foreign Policy Association to create a special edition of their Great Decisions magazine focused on the most significant challenges the next U.S. president will face. We have had episodes on strategic stability and critical countries. And today we're going to have an eclectic series, an eclectic discussion on SARS, trade, and T cells. Before I introduce my fellow panelists and my colleagues, I want to remind you that we will have a discussion section during this episode today. And you can, of course, if you don't know by now on Zoom, send in questions using the chat button at the bottom of the screen. But I'm thrilled to be joined by three eminent colleagues of mine at the Hoover Institution: Lucy Shapiro, who is a senior fellow at Hoover and a professor in Stanford School of Medicine; Mike McFaul, who is the Peter and Helen Bing Senior Fellow, the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute at Stanford, and a professor of political science, and of course, former ambassador to Russia; and John Taylor, the George Shultz Senior Fellow in Economics and professor of economics at Stanford. So welcome, everyone. Lucy, I'd like to start with you if we can. Let's be honest, 2 years ago, we probably wouldn't even have had a chapter on public health in the Great Decisions volume. We probably wouldn't have had a discussion about public health. Going forward, it's going to be the number one thing on everyone's agenda. Are we ready for the next time? What are the lessons that we've learned from this and that the next president will have to implement to ensure that should this ever happen again, we'll be able to handle it?
Sure. Let me begin by going back a little. I'm sure it hasn't escaped anybody's notice that over the past several years, there have been waves of infectious diseases hitting our shores. We've had West Nile virus, we've had Zika, we've had dengue virus that's moving up from the tropics. We had Ebola offshore, but a great threat to us. So clearly we've been seeing a very pronounced uptick in new pathogens and old pathogens in new places. And it was a clear warning sign. Why was this happening? What major changes have been happening? Well, it was a confluence of multiple events, primarily one being climate change. And when we think about climate change, we mostly think about the melting polar regions of the world. We think about hurricanes. We think about very physical things we can look at. What we haven't been focusing on is the fact that climate change has already resulted in a redistribution of viruses, bacterial pathogens, fungal pathogens around the world, one of the major reasons being that the vectors that carry these diseases, the rats, the mice, the mosquitoes, the bats, are in new sites. And so here we have all these pathogens that we have no immunity to each other, marching around the world rapidly in a way that has not happened before. And the human population was just not ready for dealing with something like this, and especially the United States. This is all exacerbated by the fact that we live in a global village now. Jet travel, loss of borders, displaced populations, geopolitical upheavals, urban crowding, deforestation, all of this is happening to make a perfect storm. Here in the United States, it was saying, yeah, this can't be happening to us. Why us? Why this horrible pandemic strain? It was inevitable that this would happen. All of us who study this have been warning that this would happen. And in fact, it had happened. We were waiting for the one pathogen that had the characteristics of a pandemic strain. High contagion, well before symptoms. High contagion remaining after the disease. And inability to control this. Because we expected that the pandemic strain would probably be a flu and not a coronavirus, it took a while to catch up. However, in the United States, we failed to pull together with a consistent message. The response was politicized, and the US currently has the highest death and transmission rates of COVID-19 in the world. So, you know, why are we in such trouble here? So without a clear and honest communication from the government, we've lost the trust of the US population. And without that, without a clear, serious, a clear message about how serious this pandemic really is and what it's done obviously to the economy of our country, we are dealing with a raging pandemic right now. What do we have to do to bring ourselves out of this terrible time? Well, there's good news. And the good news really comes from our incredible technology. And I don't mean just the US technology, I mean global technology. And that global technology deals with understanding genetic material. It deals with understanding and sequencing DNA, the instructions in all living organisms. It allows us to do several things now to deal with future pandemics, which I must tell you are going to come. We don't know the timeline. We don't know which viruses, but it will happen. So how do we deal with this now? How does the next administration deal with being ready for something like this? Because we certainly did not maintain readiness for the coronavirus. So the first and most important thing is surveillance. We need to be able to use our DNA sequencing of every known living pathogen across the globe. And we can do this using our very advanced technology that makes this possible. We need databases up in the cloud, and we need international communication of these databases in a way that has been going on piecemeal, but we need it in a better and more consistent way. And then additionally, once you have identified a given virus or bacterial pathogen, you have to track it. So you need testing. So you have to know where the pathogen is at any given time, how it is tracking, how it is changing, so that at all times we have our finger on the pulse of whatever this pathogen is. One of the most important breakthroughs for future stability and safety on this globe is using the genetic information, the DNA and RNA knowledge of pathogens to make vaccines. One of the major changes that has occurred as a result of COVID-19 is that we have been able, by we, I mean an international consortium of scientists and pharmaceutical companies, of designing completely new vaccines that are based on genetic material. And let me just give one example, and that's the mRNA vaccine that has come out of Pfizer and BioNTech, as well as Moderna. And what is so important about that vaccine is that all you need to make the next one is the sequence of the virus, which can happen in a day. All you need to do is have the new virus, the new illness identified, immediately sequence that. And we can do that very rapidly and very accurately. Once you have that sequence, it will take a week to make a prototype vaccine, as opposed to the years that it takes to do others. And with that prototype vaccine, the next big problem, which we're facing right now, is scale up, manufacturing, and of course, distribution. But because we now know that we can rapidly make vaccines to help approach somewhere near herd immunity, that's going to be the most critical event that we can use in the future to control pandemics as they arise.
Lucy, can I, at that point, I just want to ask you, because you raised a very interesting point about in order to be able to tackle these, we have to know they're out there. We have to know where they are. We have to know what it is. And obviously, one of the great criticisms was that the Chinese government knew at some point and did not inform the WHO, did not inform the rest of the world. From your position, policy, but also as a scientist, are you able to fill in that gap in some way if you're not getting the cooperation you need? What can we do so that we're not caught by surprise next time? Yeah. Because anyone doesn't want to give out that information.
I think that this is a problem. And however, I think that my next point was going to be that we need to establish international communication. And we have to, whether it's the current WHO or some other body, we need a responsible body, an international body that has access to databases across the globe that, with respect to us, communicates to our newly empowered CDC. We must have a fulcrum of messages that go out to our population based on secure and logical data accumulated from international sources that we can then send out to people who know how to communicate about infectious disease. You know, not everybody knows how to do this. You can scare people half to death, but you can also tell them the truth in a way that makes them responsible for their actions. And so, is it a problem? Yes, of course, Misha, it's a problem. But it's something that we have to work on. And our survival depends on this. So that the communication and the transparency in communication is critical. But as is, and this is another point, is the establishment of a reliable supply chain. This again raises the specter of national versus international. We are all interdependent on the raw materials for everything from therapeutics to vaccines to PPEs. We need one another. And somehow we have to understand this problem and figure out how to work together. In addition to growing and empowering the CDC, in addition to sending up data clouds across the globe with the emerging infectious diseases, a critical issue to me is balancing and protecting the economy. So somehow we have to realize that protecting the health of our nation and protecting our economy are not two antipodal things.
Right.
They're not either or. They can't be either or. They must work together. And we have to have human behavior clearly laid out so that we can send our children to school, that we can open commerce in a way that's safe and not dealing with misinformation that has put us where we are today.
That's a perfect segue, actually, to John.
Before you hit John, I have one final point, Misha, and that is hitting the point of diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of fundamental to everything that I've been speaking about and comes back to your question about China. And I think that both the economy and diplomacy then leads logically to both John and Mike Mafal.
Well, thank you. And it is, it's actually your, from the scientific perspective, the call for how we are integrated and how we solve this to some degree gets directly to what John addressed in his essay, which was the question of free trade. Now, before coronavirus pandemic, John, we could have, you know, we would have easily had a session discussing in general whether free trade, what the Trump administration had done, what the Biden administration might do. People forget we had a trade war for 2.5 years, even before the coronavirus pandemic, but it's taken on particular urgency, both in terms of recovery from the economic hit of the pandemic, but also what Lucy says is that, you know, when you look at global supply chains and you look at access. So given all that, where do we stand with free trade going forward under a Biden administration? You just had a huge trade agreement signed in Asia, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. We've done one with Japan. We've been talking with Britain. Where do we stand going forward now?
I think what we have to recognize is that this disease, as Lucy has indicated, has made it even more difficult. It's put roadblocks to international trade, international communication, and we have to find ways to get around that. I think basically we know deep down inside that the ability to trade in goods and services is a good. It's good within the United States, it's good within areas, and it's good across the world. The problem is, how do you get there? And for many years, we got there through the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. So we would reduce our tariffs if you reduce your tariffs. And that worked very well for a long time. I think what has made it more difficult is certain countries have gotten out of line, and one was China, a lot of impediments to trade. And so the United States needed to think about how to do that. How do you negotiate with one of the sides is out of the line? And that's what I think you've seen the struggle about recently. I think the important thing is to keep in mind that there's a benefit of reducing the barriers. And Lucy just mentioned this supply chain issue. I mean, it's huge because people say, well, we have to produce all the goods in the United States, all the minerals. Well, that's just not possible. And you've seen people say that. So we need to look to alternatives. I think, you know, it used to be that you wanted to have manufacturers of textiles in the United States so that we could produce military uniforms. Well, a little bit of inventory was enough to deal with that. And so we could produce military uniforms, wherever they happen to be. So there are ways to around it. And I think going forward, we need to be creative. And I think the supply chain may be a big one. There's and more generally, this concern about, again, what Lucy mentioned, the spread. We're a global village is what she used. So how do you combat that? And I think the economy is a big part of this. A lot of the disruption that has occurred this year is because of the economic, stay in place and social distancing. So what is happening, I think this is partly answering your question and the issues that Lucy raised, we're looking for alternatives. This medium we're using now, I see there's 452 people involved. It's an alternative. You know, it used to be you'd have to have a room with all those people. That's impossible. But I give a class this quarter, 350 students, Stanford students all over the world. It's in a way, it's a miracle. Anyway, we need telemedicine and Zoom technology. Anyway, those are the things that we can look forward to in a more optimistic note, but it's very difficult for sure.
So what do you think? I mean, you've had a lot of experience. What do you think, seeing the team that Joe Biden's put together, and in fact, just today he announced Susan Rice as the head of his domestic policy council. Do you think they're going to go back to first potentially into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has a slightly different name now, go back into big trade agreements that would also try to adapt to these new circumstances that you've been talking about, which include supply chain issues?
Well, I think so. I hope they'll do things that are conducive to that. It's a a change is good. I mean, there is a real question about people questioning free trade. It's across parties. It may be more of an issue in the Democratic Party than the Republican. So I think my own view is try to combat that and point to the benefits of trade. And you're not there instantly, but it's going to be more difficult. So I think Janet Yellen is a Treasury Secretary. She's had tremendous experience in government. She was 20 years thereabouts working at the Federal Reserve. And so brings in an international perspective from that viewpoint too. And I think actually this is an area where we need to think internationally. And the position at the National Security Council, National Economic Council, the Treasury, the Fed, the State Department, the Defense Department, it's a multi-agency effort. And the more that is coordinated, the better. Diplomatic efforts have to be a big part of this. But I think that's what I am concerned about, is how do we move maybe back towards the Trans-Pacific Partnership, whatever happens to be. How do we deal with these new issues from a different perspective? I think so far you've seen a rather pragmatic set of appointments that are looking for ways to deal with this, not just one way that's been talked about a lot.
So some would argue that in the Trump years, you saw other countries begin to step into the breach, if you interpret it in those terms, of Japan being one. When the Trump administration pulled out of the TPP, Japan didn't let it fall apart. It went forward with a slightly reconfigured TPP. Of course, we're also about 2 or 3 weeks away from Britain likely coming out of the EU with no deal. And so they're going to have to be renegotiating. What does that landscape look like to you? Is it that the U.S. is now just, are we still first among equals? Should we be the world leader in trying to get these pacts? Or is that other countries are going to be doing it and we can pick and choose where we want to come in and out?
I think the role of the U.S. Going back to the end of World War II has just been awfully important for promoting free markets, free peoples, et cetera. And that it goes back for a long time. I think even what happened in China, Deng Xiaoping's efforts just had tremendous effect. You had Reagan, you had Thatcher. That was part of the U.S. playing a role here, a global role based on its amazing success. Now that's being challenged by various parties. We're going to hear more about that from Mike McFaul, I'm sure. But I think we have to go back to that. There are so many success stories. I just listed this medium we're using now, all the things that are happening. DoorDash, who is a newspaper this morning, a huge, both of those, by the way, were invented by people born in China. It's just an amazing, and here they are American companies. So the U.S. has a real historical advantage here to lead, and I think it'd be good if we go back to that. We've maybe lost a little bit of it, partly because it's more confusing now. What should the role of government should be? What should the role of market should be? But I think it's been a very constructive role, and it's going to be even more important, more difficult going forward. But I think it's very important that we stress that and have partners that go along with us in stressing it too.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, I'm Michael Auslan of the Hoover Institution. This is Great Decisions, America in the World. We're talking with Lucy Shapiro, John Taylor, and Mike McFaul. Mike, I'd like to turn over to you, batting cleanup today. We can talk about international community. We can talk about international cooperation. But at the end of the day, we're dealing with countries and we're dealing with leaders of countries. When Joe Biden is inaugurated in January, he will be Vladimir Putin's fifth U.S. president. Where do we stand with Russia today? Where do you see the prospects for the relationship going? But in the broader sense of what we've been talking about, have we gotten Russia right over the past two decades of Putin? When we're talking about these new types of cooperation, these new types of challenges, We spent so many decades thinking about Russia, focusing on Russia, and then it was as if it just disappeared. We spent all our time now talking about China, but Russia's still there. So where do we stand, and what do you foresee going forward with Putin and Biden in the next half decade?
Well, first, thanks for having me. Second, congratulations on your terrific publications, Great Decisions. If you haven't got a copy yet, you should. There's a fantastic list of authors, just an incredible list of authors. I was shocked, Misha, that you got all those people to write for you. And the other thing everybody should know, if you haven't seen it, they're all very easily readable, digestible pieces, which is not always the strength of academics sometimes. I once had a professor, a history professor, who our first assignment was to write the history of the world on one page. And then the last assignment in the class was to write a 30-page paper about one day in Poland in World War II. And you need to be able to go back and forth between those things. And you guys made us do that. So I really congratulate you in what you've done in this volume. To your question about Russia, because you asked a really big question as well as a small one about what is needs to be done in the short term. But I want to start with your big question. Did we get Russia right or wrong? I think those of us who focused on internal politics and the difference between free societies and non-free societies, autocratic regimes versus democratic regimes, and use that as part of our framework, did a better job of explaining what's gone on in the Soviet Union first, then the collapse of the Soviet Union, and now our tensions with Russia today, than those that just focused on power and the balance of power in the international system. And that's a fundamental debate. You know it well, for those that study relations between states. But I think it's quite important to remember that. And I would add China here as part of that. I think it matters how states interact if they believe in ideas defining a free society that I'm reading behind your head there, Misha, or not. And tragically, Russia did not consolidate democratic institutions and market institutions in the 1990s. They tried. We tried to help them. It failed. And as Russia has become more autocratic, and I would say less market friendly, that is a cause. It's not the only cause, but that's been a cause of our tensions moving forward, most certainly in the Putin days. And it is an amazing fact that you just said Putin's now on to his fifth president. And every time we get to this moment, by the way, in history, there's a giant debate in Washington. What should Washington do to improve the relations, right? So Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, and now it's Biden. I always like to ask, well, what is Putin going to do to improve relations? You know, why is it always on our side? But I think on the Russia piece today, there's actually quite a bit of consensus now. I actually think there's going to be a lot of continuity between the Trump administration's policy towards Russia and the Biden administration's policy towards Russia. President Biden himself is not going to try to befriend Vladimir Putin in the way that President Trump has tried to do that. And, you know, sometimes that works, by the way. I want to be clear, it's better to have communication between leaders than not. But that didn't really work because Putin fundamentally was not interested in a more cooperative relationship with the United States. For his own domestic political purposes, he needs us as an enemy. And so I think we're going to set, my prediction is that President Biden and his team will set aside the idea of trying to befriend Putin personally. But I think they'll have a lot of continuity with respect to containment and deterrence. So sanctions were in place. The Trump administration increased them. I don't think that'll change. NATO, there was an idea after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014 to strengthen NATO. The Trump administration continued that, and I don't see that changing. I think that's the right policy, and tragically, it needs to be robust. Third, there was an idea that we needed to help democracy and markets in Ukraine as a way to help to contain and deter Russian foreign policy belligerent behavior in that region. That has been neglected, by the way. I don't think that that's kind of fallen off the radar. I hope that the Biden administration will get more serious about it. I actually think that is the most fundamental issue moving forward, is not how you contain Russia, but how you strengthen Ukraine, democratic Ukraine, capitalist Ukraine, as a buffer and as a way to contain Russian belligerent behavior. And then within that, I think there are pockets of cooperation. You know, when I teach about this and when I was in the government, and he's on my mind because he's about to turn 100, the best guide for how to deal with Russia today, and maybe even some lessons for dealing with China today, is actually chapter 25 of George Shultz's memoir. I was looking for it. I think it's somewhere else in my house, but it, I think, is a brilliant guide for how to deal with autocratic regimes. And in chapter 25, it's called Reengaging the Soviets. And it was about 1982, by the way. It was not about Gorbachev. That's easy. When Gorbachev shows up, that's the easy part. But George there, to remind everybody, our former Secretary of State in the Reagan administration, and our colleague here at the Hoover Institution, who we're celebrating this week, he talks about this idea that some issues are so important that you even have to deal with and engage what back then he and Ronald Reagan called the evil empire. And for him, it was arms control. We had to deal with them because we couldn't allow these two countries to blow up the planet. But he says two other important things in that chapter. While re-engaging the Soviets in that domain, we need to continue to push back and contain, and even back then, roll back communism. That was part of the Reagan doctrine, at the same time. And I think a lot of American analysts think that you got to do one or the other. And the brilliance of the Reagan strategy was they did both at the same time, and they didn't link progress in one to the other. They pursued them in parallel. And then the other thing that George says in that chapter, which I think is just perfect advice for the Biden administration, when you engage on arms control in the morning, you don't check your values at the door. And there's, I don't know if it's in chapter 25, but there's somewhere in his book where he talks about in the morning, he dealt with arms control. And then in the afternoon, he talked about opening a consulate in Kiev. And his Soviet interlocutors were like, this is you know, small ball. This is not as important for us. And he's like, no, democracy, human rights, engaging with Soviet society is not small ball for us. And I want to talk about that in our bilateral relationship with you today. And I think if the Biden team just read chapter 25 of George's book, they would do very well in dealing with Putin's Russia today.
Thank you. Mike, I want to ask you a question before that. First, I want to apologize for any background noise you may be picking up out here. Secondly, for those who would like to ask questions, please use the chat function at the bottom of the page. We're going to turn to those in just a minute. But Mike, I know you've been spending a lot of time, in fact, looking at China as well as an expert on authoritarian systems. For those of us who used to look at the history, we know there's no love lost between Russia and China historically, but certainly over the past decade or so, there's been an increasingly close relationship. Where do you see that going forward? Is there any room for maneuver for the US or allies, or Japan in particular? Do you really believe this is a tight relationship, or simply how much of a problem does it pose for us?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you're the historian, I'm not. So I'm going to ask you, you know, forgive me if I make mistakes. I think probably you have to go back to the first couple of weeks of when Mao seized power in China to remember a time when they were closer, Beijing and Moscow. And as you know better than I, it didn't last very long. You know, it quickly fell apart. And that was a great advantage to us during the Cold War. We need to remember that one of the great advantages is that there was that Sino-Soviet split, and it's not there today. They're closer today on many, many dimensions than any time in history. I think it's a shallow relationship, right? And over decades, it'll fall apart. And the Russians most certainly fear the Chinese, especially, you know, the first vodka, they're still talking about cooperation. By the fourth vodka, they're talking about how they are afraid of the Chinese. And likewise, I've spent two of the last four summers in Beijing talking to their experts about Russia. And I'm very struck by the way they talk about the Russians as these peasants who can't get their act together. And so deeper structural things will happen in the long run. But in the short term, they're united, and they're principally united about ideas defining a free society versus not. And I think we have tragically, but we need to understand it. We have entered a new power, a new era of great power competition that is fundamentally structured between those countries that believe in markets and democracy versus those that don't. And in that construct, Russia and China are going to be aligned, I think, for a long time into the future.
Thank you.
And to be more clearly, we need to be better aligned with those countries that believe in freedom. So to your point about Japan, Australia, India, but also in Europe, I think we've got to understand that this is about ideas. I think we've been kind of, most certainly in Europe and most certainly with regard to Putin, we kind of, you know, we thought we won the Cold War. We thought that the battle of ideas was over. We could just move on to other things. And Putin has a different view of that. He thinks fundamentally that the era of liberalism, and when I use that L word, I mean it's small L, not big L. But he told the Financial Times last year, he said, you know, liberalism's dead and our ideas are on the ascendancy. And he's got a brand of conservative orthodox nationalism that he's trying to propagate in the world. By the way, spending billions of dollars to propagate those ideas in the world. And I think we're behind them. I think we've got to catch up. And by the way, I think Hoover has a big role to play in this ideological struggle. I want to use that word, that phrase on purpose, that has returned to international politics.
Mike, thank you. And I think that's just a huge point. You know, we got to what we thought might be the end of history. It was certainly the end of the Cold War. And we thought ideology didn't matter. And we've got to get used again to thinking about ideology and recognizing others take it seriously and that it does shape their worldview. I want to move to questions now. Apparently, I may have said to folks online, use the chat function. I, of course, meant to say use the Q&A function, not the chat function. So please send your questions in by Q&A. And let's open them because we've got a lot and we obviously won't get to all of them. I'll try to group them together. Lucy, we do have a few for you that were really taken with the arguments you were making about the interconnectedness that we have. And yet at the same time, that interconnectedness helping spread the COVID pandemic itself. So how do you square the circle on one hand, recognizing that to some degree, as you noted, in a global village and in a globalization, we can't draw up the drawbridges the way that we used to. We tried a little bit, but then calling for more globalization to solve it, which certainly makes sense from a scientific view, but how do we put those together? We're more at risk, but it's also the way we protect ourselves.
Yeah, I think that the problem is, Misha, that we don't have an option. We have to solve this problem. Is it simple? No. But there are ways of doing this. And communicating with databases across the cloud, across international barriers that are not up there in the cloud and we can control, is going to be vital. The most important part of this is going to be not only the information chain, but the supply chain and the ability to realize that we cannot go this alone. We have resulted in a raging pandemic here in the United States because of not making the kinds of attempts to internationally coordinate. Is this going to be easy? No. Is there a ready answer for you? No. That's why we need a lot of smart people working together with diplomacy, with economists, with database people, and listening to your scientific community, which is one of the best in the world. And without that, we're going to be in very serious trouble, as we are today.
Well, it's interesting. You raised the diplomacy question. Mike raised the diplomacy question. John did indirectly this point about, you know, Mike was saying in George Shultz's memoirs, the small ball can be as important as the, you know, the big game. And also in what you're saying, that you have to have both the big vision, but then, you know, you have to have these connections among and working relations. So clearly we're in a period of having to return to that without, as you said, a prepackaged answer. John, I wanted to, there's some questions on the recovery and the unevenness of it around the globe. So here, clearly we had a very sharp, you know, unprecedentedly, historically sharp contraction, maybe never seen anything like it before. There was belief that it would be a V-shaped rebound, meaning an equally sharp recovery because of, as Lucy's mentioned, we're into, I don't know if this is the second or the third wave, whatever we're into, that may be stalling things out a little bit. There were some questions about how does the next administration prioritize getting the economic recovery going full force? And also connected with that, the role that China may play in that recovery and driving it, even though China, of course, has had severe economic impact from all of this. So how do you see that?
Well, first of all, we have had a kind of, if you look at the data, it looks pretty V-ish. You know, you had a huge rebound, 33% growth in the third quarter, and maybe the fourth will not be quite that large, but people are talking about 5 or 6. So I think to some extent that's reflecting people are finding these alternatives, you know, not so-called non-star retail sales are skyrocketing. I mentioned telemedicine, all the other things that are happening. To some extent, that's not going to be the whole thing. We got to get back to some degree of normal. And then I think it's important that we try to get a better growth rate. We have not been doing that well. And here, I think this question about regulation is important. You know, one question which come up, Mike raised this, is why did the Chinese seem to have moved faster in fintech? Well, I point to we have a lot of regulatory and barriers, and that should be a focus. And, you know, in fact, we may be going the wrong way in some of these actions against the high tech firms that are near us. So I think that's something to watch for, the regulatory effects. I think also, we should be communicating more about the value of free markets and free people. It's still there. We got tremendous data. Data are out there on our side. And the more we emphasize that, the better. It's not government. Government has an important role to play, but it's free markets, the private sector. And we can go down the list of what's happening right now. And I think the more we can stand for that, the better. And that's part of this ideological discussion which we're having. I mean, how the Russian people, all that good shape? Well, I don't think so. And part of the reason is they have a different approach. You could point to certain aspects of China, but China's slowing. And so I would go back to this basic data and emphasize it. It's sort of the economic analogy of what Lucy has been stressing. Let's get the as much as we know clear to people. And don't be sheepish about it, because the facts are on our side.
So can I Ed asks a question. I'd like to ask you, John, and then we've got one that I think is good for you and Mike as well. Ed asks, are Trump's tariffs to pressure China working and helping the U.S. should Biden continue them? That brings us to that pre-COVID world of the trade war, which we were all focused on until about January of this year.
So I think that they're not working, but of course we've had an enormous intrusion in this COVID-19, which makes it hard to interpret. I was more positive a year ago that these actions reflect, as I mentioned before, a change in circumstances compared to where we were before. So a little bit of, we're gonna raise our tariffs we're doing that and we'll reduce them when you reduce yours. But so far that has not worked as much as I'd like to have seen it working. So that means we need to, I think I would say, go back to our ultimate goal is free trade. Our ultimate goal is free markets. Our ultimate goal is free peoples. That's all part of the same story. And the more we can do that, the better. So that's where I would go. I noticed one of the other questions is about Janet Yellen at the Fed. Well, someone said the Fed has just set interest rates. What kind of free market is that? Well, I think the Fed, actually Yellen has emphasized this, a more rules-based policy would not be so bad. And so having another voice in the government for a more rules-based approach is consistent with the other things I'm saying. And that may indeed happen.
I was actually going to ask that question, but not having taken your economics one, I didn't fully understand it, so I skipped. So I'm glad you grappled with it. Thank you. You've mentioned freedom a couple of times. And actually, this is for all three of you, because each of you has discussed it in different ways. We have a question from Jack about how do you protect privacy rights with large-scale databases? And we can think about this in terms of medical information, Lucy, the types of things you were talking about. John, in terms of the fintech question you just asked, you know, massive databases that capture everything. Mike, you know very well from looking at China, this social credit system that's being evolved based on massive amounts of data. So if we're in that world, and it looks like we're not backing out of that world, and we may need that world in order to solve pandemics or other things, how do we protect freedom, privacy, the very things that we cherish the most that we've been talking about here? That's for all of you to just jump in. So, anyone. I can be a professor again and, you know, call on my fellow professors, but Lucy, well, if you don't mind taking it, because—
real quick, just a couple of, yeah. Because I know the least, so I'll give my colleagues time to answer more comprehensively. I mean, one is for democracies to be more cooperative on these issues. And so we need to be setting standards. We need to be cooperating. We need to have our own cloud. We need to have our own information sharing between democracies with the kind of norms that come with protecting privacy as a way to change the kind of balance of power on these things within the world more broadly speaking. That to me, I think, has been lost. And, you know, there's lots of ideas, you know, D10, D20, T12, Tech12. But to get back into more cooperative space as opposed to antagonistic space. And second, I don't have the answer, because now I'm going to ask John to have the answer. As somebody who's not an expert, I see a bit of a paradox that makes me nervous. On the one hand, everybody agrees China's the enemy and we have to organize together. I have a more nuanced view of that myself, but there is consensus about China's rise challenging us and their fintech companies and all their other companies too, not just fintech. On the other hand, it was in the paper today, as John just said, we want to break up Facebook. And does that help our competition with China, or does that hinder our competition? And I don't know enough. I could see advantages to more freedom in the market that might overall be in the long run good for the America and good for the free world. But I sometimes feel like that's a tension, right? That research and development, for instance, we need our companies to be doing more in research and development. We're way behind the Chinese on that. How do we achieve that that balance in terms of, you know, is big always better or is big not so good? But John, now I defer to you. I'm really interested in your answer.
Well, I think we agree that part of what's holding the U.S. back, holding us back, is the regulatory apparatus. We've got so many regulatory agencies involved in fintech, the Treasury, the Fed, the OSC. And so it's all over the place. And I think a concerted effort to say this is holding us back, let's not continue with it. Let's change. And there are people working on this, to be sure. Some are coming out of the firms that are being attacked. But I think the attack worries me, quite frankly, because if you think about the U.S. versus China and the development of fintech, I think the U.S. will add these concerns, which are these freedom concerns, individual concerns, privacy concerns, which tends to go the opposite way from what we've seen so far coming out of China. So our being active and big and really letting our companies move, I think, is the way to go. And I think the antitrust is, you know, I'm an old-fashioned person. Antitrust, does it really restrain the size of the market? I don't see that at this point. So I would hold back on that and take advantage of this incredible technology that's happening right here as we speak. It's all over the place. DoorDash, I mentioned already, and that's the thing that we're good at. We should do. It's consistent with our basic philosophy of free markets and freedom.
So just following on from that, and from the first point that Mike made, the kinds of open communication that will help us not only stabilize economic relations, but most importantly, track and ultimately win the battle that we're in with a pandemic is open communication. And it's not that we are trespassing on people's privacy when we're following the sequences of a virus. We are not trespassing on people's personal freedoms when we understand the groups of hotspots, not only around the world, but around the United States that we must control. So tracking, identifying, and then seeing the results of the vaccine program that we are now watching being launched globally is going to be vital to our survival and protection. If a given vaccine has some side effects that we didn't know about, we're going to know about them pretty soon because we have open communication. And the worst thing we could do is, you know, bring up the drawbridges and not listen to what's happening, not only around the world, but at different parts of the United States. We need this information for both our health and economic survival. And it really does not impinge on our private freedoms.
Lucy, I want to ask you, it almost sounds like we've gone so far past this in certain ways, but I think it gets to your point about, because all of this is about future prevention now, or at least mm-hmm. it will be when we eradicate this or get it under control. But we did have a question on, are we confident that we actually understand the origin of the virus? And we know there's tons of theories out there, weaponization, man-made, natural, accidental release, whatever it was. But if we don't really know how this came about and evolved, and I guess there's different aspects to it. It's where did it actually come from? And then how did it get out? You know, how can we protect ourselves? So it seems almost retro to ask the question, but from your vantage point as a scientist, do we really know what happened?
So I think there are questions. I think that the consensus scientifically is that it was not engineered in a laboratory. Whether it escaped from a laboratory, we don't know. We here in the United States do not have a great record of protecting our very highly infectious agents. Things get out in one way or the other. Mostly, it's Mother Nature we're up against. Mm-hmm. Mostly, it's the transmission of viruses from pools of animals to humans and their mutation rate to give you contagious strains. So all of this will be and should be tracked by now our ability to follow and sequence the etiology of every new strain we see. In fact, there was quite a bit of communication between American scientists and the Wuhan Institute, where was at the fulcrum of this release, quote unquote, of the COVID virus. And that was stopped bango can't talk to each other anymore. This is not sane. This does not make sense. We must talk to each other. We must follow things through, because there's blowback if you don't. And we can't go forward. You know, you said, Misha, you mentioned prevention. It's not just prevention. It's once it's out, taking care of it and bringing it down. And so we cannot prevent every infectious agent getting out there and doing bad stuff. We have to know how to rapidly identify it, rapidly have in place measures that will quell the pandemic. And I laid out what I thought were the series of things that were important. So I think that going forward, what's critical is open communication internationally, because it's going to affect every country and every economy.
And Lucy, just to clarify, when you said that the communication between the U.S. scientists and the Wuhan scientist was stopped, yes, that was on the part, I'm assuming, of the Chinese government is what you were referring, ours.
No.
On ours?
Both.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Okay.
And I mean, there were groups that suddenly couldn't talk anymore.
Okay.
And it wasn't coming just from the Chinese.
Okay, I didn't know that. So well, that's something to follow up on. Mike, we have a question. In part, if I can ask you to put on your Larry Diamond hat, but also the Mike McFaul hat of dealing with authoritarian regimes, which is from Nicholas. And he asks, if we grant that much of the world is not democratic, how can the U.S. Push the non-democratic nations closer to, he asks, a Singapore model? I think you could choose other models, but I understand what he's asking, which is an interesting question, because normally we think of it in very binary terms, right? You're either democratic, you're not democratic, we want you our side. But, you know, is there a third way, non-aligned, maybe we might call it, but is there a third way that might be more realistic as you've surveyed how you deal with non-democratic nations? Instead of saying full on, you have to be democracies, what can we do to get them closer?
It's interesting you ask that question, because I'm writing a paper about it right now. I published a book with Hoover called Advancing Democracy Abroad, Why We Should and How We Can, back in 2010. And back then, in talking about the relationship between democracy and development, I was still more of a supporter of Singapore is on the way to a different political system of government, right? And it's called modernization theory. You develop the economy first, and then there's people get richer, and then there's a demand for greater political freedom and eventually democracy. I'm more skeptical of that model today than I was when I wrote that book 10 years ago. It's still available on Amazon, by the way, for whoever asked. Look it up, Advancing Democracy Abroad. And here's why. Number one, we've had some countries that have advanced in terms of their economic, both size of the economy and GDP per capita, that do not show signs of political liberalization. Obviously, China is the most important country in that case. But even Russia, you know, Russia was doing that for a while. And Russia is not the basket case that people think of it, by the way. Russia is actually economically richer today than they've ever been, probably in their 1,000-year history. We have this notion from the early 90s, and it's outdated. But and there are other countries, too, that they have developed economically. And you don't see that pressure yet for political change. Now, I'm still an optimist. I still think in the long run, that will be true. And in the long run, you know, the richest countries in the world, GDP per capita, almost all of them are democracies, if you take out the oil exporters. But in the short run, I'm more skeptical of this. And that, therefore, I think we need to be, in terms of what we should do as a country, not just funding development for development's sake, but to have it intertwined with market institutions and democratic institutions. You know, USAID, the Agency for International Development, they just have a small little piece on governance and democracy. I think that's wrong. I think, especially in this era when we're competing with the Chinese model, and they're offering a different alternative development model, we need to be much more explicit about seeing the and promoting the intertwining of democratic institutions and market institutions. Because, you know, I think there it's a hypothesis that the Chinese model might not lead to, more open political institutions over time. And we've got to be more skeptical of that earlier theory. Remember back, 30 or 40 years ago, and I supported this, I want to be clear, the World Bank worked in China, right? That we provided a lot of external assistance to drive that economy. And I think that was right. I want to be clear, under Deng, like John said, greatest poverty reduction probably in the history of the world. But the notion that that would later lead to political change, that has not become true, at least not in the short run. And therefore, I think we need to be engaged in this where we think of political, democratic, open institutions, liberal institutions, and economics institutions of the same sort as being more intertwined, not sequenced.
I think that's a perfect point to wrap up, because it's actually an optimistic point, and it's something that Lucy's mentioned, John has stressed, you've stressed, to unabashedly embrace the values question, but as values are translated into institutions, into actual policies, diplomacy and communication. Some ways it seems like it's sort of back to the future. Some of our colleagues, and I agree with them, are calling that we should be reinstating the U.S. Information Agency. And you've been talking about how we can improve the role of USAID. So in some ways it's going back to fundamentals, but those were fundamentals that worked for a very long time, but they'll have to be tweaked into a new era. This has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank each of you for joining, Lucy, John, Mike. Thank our those who have been watching us, either for this one or all three of the series. We hope you enjoyed it. Again, it was a great decisions volume that you can get. We're going to try to make some of it available as well. There's Mike's book. There's everything, of course, on the Hoover website. But most importantly, these are questions that are not solved today. They begin in some ways in January of next year. So we hope that you've enjoyed our series, but also that you will join us at Hoover as we continue to discuss the great decisions that America will have to make in the world. I'm Michael Auslan. Thank you very much.